everyone. It is Friday, August 24th, 2012. This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola. I'm coming to you from my office in the suburbs of Chicago. Thanks for joining me today, and thanks for listening to RBN. For people who can distinguish the difference between the truth and disinformation and indoctrination, and can recognize those gatekeepers. To see the guest lineup for Studios A and B, please click on the word schedule in the RBN banner at the top of the page at republicbroadcasting.org. Please visit the radio schedule page at spingola.com to see a list of my guests together with links to their websites. For questions or comments only during the program, please email spingola1 at yahoo.com. Otherwise, my regular email is deanna at spingola.com. Please hold your calls until we open the phone lines in the second hour. Then you may call 800-313-9443. My guest today is Carl Radl. R-A-D-L. He is the author of Communism and the Jews, a source reader. His website is SemiticController.blogspot.com. Carl, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me back, Deanna.
Well, thank you. I so appreciate the series that you did on the kosher tax. And people can find that at your website. Just go to the website, SemiticController.blogspot.com, and on the left-hand side, you will see all of the articles that he has written. And the kosher food tax is, I think it's probably one of the best that you've done. Of course, I say that about all of them, each one that I read, I think. That is so good. This sure, certainly must be the best, but anyway, you've got a lot of really great stuff there.
Well, thank you. it's nice to know I'm appreciated sometimes. I get a lot of abuse from Jews.
Oh, I wonder why.
I wonder.
Oh, goodness. I guess that comes with the territory that you've chosen to engage in, to enter
it
into.
Does. Yeah.
But that's okay. It shows that you have courage and that you really want to get the truth out there and educate the rest of us. And for that, I'm very grateful.
Yeah, you're more than welcome. It's almost a hobby now, I think.
Yes. Well, it's good to have. I mean, it's certainly better than sitting around playing cards and doing, you know, other things that are simply a waste of time.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, definitely. Today we wanted to talk about the relationship between Jews and the Soviet Union. And to do that...
Yes.
Okay. I thought you were going to say something then. To do that, we must understand the Russian Empire. Now, the Russian Empire, for love it or hate it, it has a very strange history of... relationship with the Jews throughout history. It's one of the major empires. It was one of the empires that really took the Jews in the Middle Ages. But as history progressed, the Russians became more and more opposed to Jews. You have the famous policy where the Russians would conscript Jews, and they would say they'd conscript. I think it was 1 in 10 of all Jewish children would be forcibly conscripted by the state, when they were very young, sent into the army, converted to Orthodox Christianity, and used on the front lines as a sort of a Mamluk unit, to use the Ottoman variation of the policy from whence it derives. This in itself indicates, it gives us some idea of just how the Jews operated in Russia, because their entire industry developed around getting around all this legislation, so that all the children of the rabbis didn't have to go, but the children of the Jewish workers did, for example.
Oh, selection, huh? Just have certain people go. All righty, we do have a 3-minute break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors.
In 2010, millions of people were awakened to the question of what. Now the next question that remains to be answered is, Why in the world are they spraying? An investigative look into one of the many agendas associated with chemtrail geoengineering programs, weather control. Why in the world are they spraying? Premiering and streaming live August 18th at the three-day event, Consciousness Beyond Chemtrails Conference and Fundraiser in Los Angeles. For more info, go to www.cbclive2012.com. Why in the world are they spraying? Order your copy today at www.whyintheworldaretheyspraying.com. Watch the premiere live August 18th at the three-day event, Consciousness Beyond Chemtrails Conference and Fundraiser in Los Angeles. For more info, go to www.cbclive2012.com. Why in the world are they spraying?
And if you control the weather, you're going to control the planet. It's that simple.
American gardeners and fellow patriots, make the right choice with your money, time, and your family food supply. Choose 100% pure heirloom seeds in the Survival Seed Vault from MyPatriotSupply.com. Why spend more? The Survival Seed Vault from MyPatriotSupply.com is only $37.95 and includes 20 varieties of pure, hardy, easy-to-grow heirloom seeds. Yes, only $37.95. That's 70% less than our competitors. You could buy three Survival Seed Vaults for less than one of theirs. The Survival Seed Vault from MyPatriotSupply.com includes detailed planting and seed saving instructions and ships same day. Plus, all orders over $49 ship free. MyPatriotSupply.com is American owned by patriots like you, passionate about freedom and preparedness. Call now, 866-229-0927. That's 866-229-0927. Or discover more emergency preparedness items when you order at MyPatriotSupply.com. Choose the original. Choose the Survival Seed Vault at MyPatriotSupply.com.
Hey, honey, I'm home. I grabbed a newspaper on the way home. Look at all the news today.
Don't you know that all you're going to get in the newspaper is propaganda, twisted news, and false information?
Honey, this is a national newspaper. It has to be true.
Ha! For some reason, the majority of the population believe anything the mainstream media tells them. The newspaper doesn't give out the important attention of what's happening to this country and news that affects our daily lives. Say, does that newspaper mention anything about the North American Union?
No, not that I can see.
I didn't think so. You need to go to www.newswithviews.com, where truth is more important than political correctness. That's www.newswithviews.com. Hey, don't throw that away. We can use that in the birdcage.
Okay, move over. Let me start reading newswithviews.com.
The truth? Read all about it at newswithviews.com. Newswithviews.com, where reality shatters illusion.
Alrighty, we are back. This is Deanna. My guest today is Carl Rattle, and his website is SemiticController.blogspot.com. And Carl, what time period are we talking?
We're talking 18th to mid to sort of late 19th century. That's okay. When that policy was active. It was gotten rid of in the mid to late 19th century because it was considered outdated and it didn't really produce the desired effect, which was basically to de-Judaize Russia by creating lots of Christians who were of Jewish origin. That didn't work. So they got rid of it, and then you had a situation where Tsar Alexander was assassinated in 1881. And one of the people involved in that assassination, from a bunch of nihilists, was a Jewess, a young Jewish woman. And that was the original spark for the famous pogroms that occurred and that weren't actually anything to do with the Russian state, just the Russian state was slow to mobilize against to stop them, contrary to received wisdom. What gets interesting is that the amount of Jews in the underground, the left-wing underground at this time, the importance of understanding the historical policy is to point out that Jews were not in a good light. They were not helped. But they weren't particularly discriminated against either. They were forced into a territorial zone. But it was quite easy to get out of it if you had the money and the connections to do so. So it wasn't nearly as bad as is usually suggested. It just held most of them together. of that, to give some idea of the left-wing Jewish involvement of the time, in 1898, 18.7% of all the people arrested for revolutionary activities were Jewish. While in 1899, that number had risen to 24.85%, and it continued sort of slowly rising up to the 1914, 1916, where it goes up to 30 to 40% of those arrested. It gives you some idea of the scale of the problem with to do with Jews and left-wing views that there was in Russia at the time. A conservative estimate by Luch Diner in the Israeli academic journal Zion puts the Jewish labor movement at this time in Russia at least 70,000 active members, and while the Zionist Socialist Movement, as an additional, had at least 27,000 active members in Russia by 1907. Gives you some idea of the scale of it. Indeed, Lenin, in early 1917, said, the hatred of the Tsars was particularly directed against the Jews. On one side, the Jews provided an extremely high percentage of the leaders of the revolutionary movement. In passing, it should be said, to their credit today, that today the Jews provide a relatively high percentage of representatives of internationalism compared with other nations. That's from Lenin, the 1929 edition of his works, volume 19, pages 354 to 355. That was confirmed by Khrushchev in the 1950s, when he told a visiting French socialist delegation that at the outset of the revolution, we had many Jews in the leadership of the party and state. They were more educated and more revolutionary than the average Russian. And that's from the French magazine Réalité in May 1957. From that, we can get some idea of just how important the Jews were to the left-wing movements in the Russian Empire and then later in the early Soviet Union. To understand that, you have to see that the Pale of Settlements, was a laboratory of extremes. You have three very different traditions which came out of it. One, you have the Zionist tradition, because Chaim Weizmann, David Ben-Gurion, Zeev Jabotinsky, and Asher Ginzburg were all originally from the Pale of Settlement, before they had their Zionist epiphanies. In many cases, they became Zionist in their local area. While Trotsky, Zinoviev, Kamenev, Yoff, and Litvinov were all, again, from the Pale. You've got Zionists, and you've got the Bolsheviks, and you've got them sort of the Marxists. In addition to that, you've also got the Hasidim, the highly religious Jews, who were massively represented in the Pale of Settlement. And it was to them that there was later to be so much violence between the Zionists, the Hasidim, and the Marxists, because all three of these groups were fighting each other basically for the heart and minds of the Jewish population. In essence, Zionism and Bolshevism in particular are theoretical opposites. They can be both seen as to originate in two different sides of how Judaism views the world. In the case of Zionism, we are a special people, and therefore we're a people apart in contrast to everyone else, so therefore we must retain our purity by not marrying with the Gentiles, and this was something that that the Hasidim would agree with. The difference between the Zionism and the Hasidim is that the Zionists advocated an actual sort of a push to achieve a secular state, whereas the Hasidim were only interested in when the Messiah turned up. So again, you get this difference between Judaism's view that the Messiah will turn up eventually and they will rule the world, and you get the Zionist view of which, okay, why wait, effectively? Let's do it now.
Now, were they more secular than the Hasidim?
The Hasidim are the most pious of all Jews, in theory, anyway. They're the origin of the Kabbalah. They also contain notable Talmuds. If you've ever been to Crown Heights in New York, you'll see all the Jews with the black and white garb and the locks and the hats. Those are the Hasidim.
Right. I've been to Manhattan. And I've been to Manhattan and, you know, 7th Avenue and whatnot, where the textile industry is. And even there, I saw quite a few of them.
Yeah, they've even got their own sort of roads, their own little police force, and so on and so forth. They've even got modesty squads who go around terrorizing women who do not conform to Hasidic sort of, shall we say, views on, you know, on covering up and that kind of thing. So you have to, you know, head covering and, you know, full length skirt. And you're not allowed to walk around with any other woman but your husband, any other man but your husband, that kind of thing. In essence, the Marxist view of the world, it also comes from Judaism. It derives off the concept of Tikkun Olam, whereby Jews are repairing the world. And basically, the Marxist assimilation's view was that they can only do that by leading the way, by getting rid of their own, what they would call their class, or their bourgeois accoutrement, they're shedding all their previous lives as, you know, as members of the normal population, their Jewish origins and so forth. And that was a very important aspect of them. So in essence, you've got three sides of the same coin, which are fighting each other at this point. And the two groups that come out as the winners in this fight are the Zionists and the Marxists. The Hasidim only have made a comeback in the 1980s and 90s, largely due to the Lubavitch of much fame, who modernized a lot of what they did, and the fact that Marxism had failed by that point.
And they also support, of course, the Israeli state.
Yeah, well, the strange one is that the Hasidim include many opponents of the Israeli state. For example, the NK, the New Lokata, are Hasidim, but they take the view that they take the more traditional view that the Jews shouldn't be in Israel as a state because that's trying to preempt God. They don't fundamentally disagree with Israel as such. They just disagree with it currently existing, because otherwise it's going to prevent the Messiah coming and leading the Jews so they can rebuild the Temple of Solomon and so forth. While many Hasidic Jews today support Israel, although traditionally they haven't. They support it because I think it provides them a home. It also provides them, ironically, with a lot of advantages. Like, for example, only recently has the law that prevents the Hasidim who enter into a yeshiva from having to serve in the Israeli army, in spite of everyone else having to. And they've also got additional benefits whereby they can get housing benefit, food stamps, and what have you in Israel for their own benefit. They kind of act like the blacks and the Mexicans of Israel in many respects. And a lot of secular Jews really, really dislike them, particularly those who live in Israel.
Right.
And, sorry?
Now, you mentioned the Pale of Settlement and that it was like 20% of the territory of Russia. And that was basically a large area where they could live and work and do whatever they wanted, really.
Yes, very much so.
And, okay. And yet they still decided, the Zionists still decided that they needed to go back, or that they needed to seize Palestine.
Yes, indeed. The fact that they ruled each other, they ruled themselves, can be very easily established by looking at the rabbinical work, which talks extensively about how they actually ruled themselves while, in quotes, under Gentile rule in theory.
Oops, I hear the music. We need to take a 3-minute break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors.
How How would you like to own land? A refuge to escape from big cities, possible food shortages, the collapse of the dollar, or just a vacation trip is now available to you. Lots of fishing and hunting are available just across the Rio Grande River. Own your personal Colorado Wilderness RV lot within three stones' throw of the Rio Grande River for $1,395. Quarter acre lots, county road access. All lots come with warranty deed. All just for $1,395. Call 785-672-3141. 785-672-3141. Or go online to coloradoriverlots.com for more information and to see photos. It is away from civilization, a good business investment, and a low-cost protection plan. Call today, 785-672-3141.
Aerial spraying, chemtrails, the modified atmosphere, heavy metals and pesticides, carcinogens and chemical fibers all falling from the sky. You have a choice to keep your body clean. Detoxify with microplant powder from hempusa.org or call 908-691-2608. It's odorless and tasteless and used in any liquid or food. Protect your family now with microplant powder. Cleaning out heavy metals, parasites, and toxins. Order it now for daily intake and stock it now for long-term storage. Visit hempusa.org or call 908-691-2608 today.
Hey there, my name is Frank Bates. What I'm about to tell you in the next 60 seconds could get me in a lot of trouble. I just created a free video presentation at 123crooks.com that exposes the electricity monopolies and government agencies for what they really are: incompetent, lying crooks that are counting on your ignorance and fear to keep your power bills criminally high. Some have called this a conspiracy. Others have called it a cover-up. And you'll be shocked to find out how deep the conspiracy goes. My video at 123crooks.com exposes the truth and shows you the secret of how I beat them and how you can beat them too. Watch the controversial video that thousands of other smart patriots have already seen in the last 3 months. Go to 123crooks.com and discover one weird trick to slash your power bill and protect your home. Go watch my video now at 123crooks.com before they force me to shut it down. 123crooks.com.
Welcome back. Our guest today is Carl Rattle. He is the author of Communism and the Jews, a source reader. His website is SemiticController.blogspot.com.
Oh,
okay. All right, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, don't worry. I was fiddling around with settings. What were we talking about?
We were talking about the Pale of Settlement and that, you know, it was 20% of the whole of Russia, and they pretty much got to do what they wanted. And then, of course, later on, you had the other area that the Russians were willing to give to them, Birobidzhan, but then they really wanted to seize Palestine.
Yes, in fact, there was a massive controversy in Zionism in the early 20th century, very early 20th century, between you had the people who are up to, it was basically Joseph Chamberlain, who was the foreign minister of the British government, who was incidentally, he was in the government of Balfour, John Balfour, who wrote, of course, the Balfour Declaration. He basically offered the Jews part of what is called the Uganda Declaration. In fact, it refers to a bit of modern Kenya. It basically was saying, okay, you can have a homeland, but it can't be Palestine. And there was a massive controversy in Zionism about it. as to whether or not they should hold out for Palestine or not. And the pro-Palestinian camp actually won pretty much hands down against those who argued that the Jews should just go and take it. I mean, after all, Herzl foresaw a Jewish state in either Palestine or Argentina. He dithered between the two all his life. But he was in fact more pro taking the view that that the Jews should just take Kenya, should just take the part of Kenya that was offered to them. And this was a source of much acrimony between Herzl and his erstwhile followers for the rest of his life until he died. The fact that the Jews got a Pale settlement is really a historical accident, because with the partition of Poland, Catherine the Great decided she didn't want 10 million Jews immigrating to, say, Moscow, or, you know, or going and just causing mayhem in the Ukraine. So she decided to effectively wall them up in the territory they traditionally lived in. That was the Pale Settlement, and in many respects, it was a very good deal for the Jews, because it was basically saying, okay, you can manage your own affairs, but you can only do so in here, and you can't go charging around the interior of Russia or the major cities unless you have a permit to do so, which effectively kept out the problem. To give you some idea of how bad the problem would have gotten had the Jews been allowed to do what they wanted to do, according to the official statistics from 1914, some 38% of all Jews in the USSR, in the Russian Empire, at the time, were what we call, have been classed as traders and middlemen. So these are the people who didn't actually produce anything. They didn't even create anything. They weren't managers of organizations. All they did was trade. And
things haven't changed much, have they?
No, they haven't. They really haven't. It actually gets far worse than that, but there you go. The fact that these people existed tells you sort of why the Russian authorities were so keen to keep them out of Russia, particularly because the Jews historically have controlled several major industries in the Pale. They controlled the sale of alcohol. Many sort of taverns were Jewish owned. They also controlled things like, you know, the sale of timber was very common Jewish industry. Precious sort of clothes, precious metals, that kind of thing. A lot of the industry of the Pale was predictably in Jewish hands, and forcing this to be the case prevented the Jews from trying to sort of own factories across Russia. Even despite that, the Jews were massively overrepresented in the factories they owned, and also the very sort of anti-labor practices that they encouraged.
Right. Now, Catherine the Great did this because of their history in other countries, yeah, and because of her own acknowledgement of their behavior. Right.
Yeah. And the important thing to stress that is that Catherine the Great was a follower of Voltaire. She was a rationalist. Although she was a believer in the Orthodox Christianity, although she was actually German and raised in a Protestant household, she held that the Jews were a dangerous people, and agreed with Voltaire that, you know, these people were fundamentally a problem. And it was, and that it transcended mere religion, and that there was something fundamentally different about them from anyone else.
Oh, indeed. All righty, we do have to go to a 3-minute break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Hey, meat eaters. The freeze-dried guy wants to know, does your emergency food supply meet the standards for survival? Then get the 144-day meat variety unit from the freeze-dried guy. Our meat units utilize only quality Mountain House freeze-dried cooked ground chicken and ground beef, the undisputed choice for great taste and highest nutrition. The freeze-dried guy's 144-day meat variety unit includes six number 10 cans of the very best freeze-dried animal protein for power you'll need when the going gets tough. Every Meat Eater's 144-day meat variety unit comes with a free medical kit and always free shipping to the lower 48. Need more than 144 days? See our one-year-plus Meat Eater's units at freezedryguy.com. And hey, the freeze-dry guy still has LRP rations, but they're going fast. Don't wait until tomorrow. Call now, 866-404-3663. That's 866-404-3663. Or go to freezedryguy.com and meet the standards for survival.
In times like these, you can't depend on the government to keep you warm and fed, but you can depend on the Vermont Bun Baker to do just that. With the Vermont Bun Baker, you'll never be in a situation where you can't cook, bake, fry, boil water, or heat your home all at the same time. One of the most revolutionary cook stoves, wood stoves ever, the Vermont Bun Baker is available with or without soapstone veneer, a natural stone that retains heat and radiates it back into the room once the fire is out. A beautiful addition to your home, the Vermont Bun Baker has an efficiency rating well above 75% and qualifies for the wood stove tax credit. For more information, watch the Vermont Bun Baker on YouTube and live stream or visit us at www.vermontwoodstove.com. You can also reach us by calling 1-866-SOAPSTONE. Don't ever be hungry or cold because the power's gone out. With a Vermont Bun Baker, all you have to worry about is what's for dinner.
If you would like to live your life free of sickness, pain, and fear, live your life with increased vitality, energy, and youthfulness, and experience your body healing itself from anything out of balance concerning cardiovascular or diabetic circulation problems, then this might be the most important ad you'll ever hear. It is possible to acquire a 100% organic nutritional supplement for a healthy heart and circulation, which works. It is extremely effective and starts to work within days. For a long and healthy life, order today by calling 866-295-5305. 866-295-5305. A healthy heart is a happy heart. Order online at heartandbody.com. That's heartandbody.com.
Welcome back. Our guest today is Carl Rattle. He is the author of Communism and the Jews, a source reader. His website is SemiticControversies.blogspot.com.
Mm-hmm. sorry,
You're taking a drink of water, right?
Yes. Actually, it was squash, but there you go.
Okay.
I was actually going to say your comment about the Jews being very typical of themselves is interesting in itself. But there is an interesting statistic. A man named André Blumel, who is the head of the Franco-Soviet Friendship League, who made many trips to the Soviet Union. And he was told in 1957, on one of his many visits to the USSR, that 50% of all Soviet state lawyers in both Leningrad, which is, of course, St. Petersburg, and Kharkov, which is a major city in the south of Russia, were Jews. And that of the 1,190 state lawyers in Moscow, some 405 of them were Jewish. That's about a third. Further, the Soviet Minister of Culture at the time, Ekaterina Fedseva, reported that some 10% of the members of the Soviet Academy of Sciences and 34% of the members of the Soviet film industry were Jewish. Again, something we should point out is that Soviet statistics work a bit differently to how most people would conceive of them. The way they tend to work was that they worked on questionnaires. So they would ask the person, what national group do you feel you come from? So if they, so they could say, so basically that means that 34% of the people in the film industry said they were Jewish, said they came from Jewish origin. But what happens if someone doesn't identify being Jewish in spite of being Jewish, or has, say, a Jewish mother or a Jewish father, but not the other parent, or, say, a Jewish grandfather, or what have you? Basically, these are low estimates, if anything. The fact that they're so high, even for low estimates, says something of the scale of how many Jews were in the USSR power base at this time. To quote Fetsieva again, this time from the National Guardian on 20th of June 1956. She says, the Soviet government has found in some of its departments a heavy concentration of Jewish people, upwards of 50% of the staff.
Oh, my word.
Now, yeah. And that is in 1956. That is after the Great Purge of 1936-1938, after the Holodomor, after the Second World War, after the, in quotes, the doctor's plot of 1948 to 1953. And, you know, and as well as, in this time you had the gulags going on, you had the secret police in proliferation. And that sort of scale gives you some idea of just how powerful these people were. In addition, to quote some more statistics to you, and I know I'm quoting a lot of statistics here.
No, I like statistics. I think they're really good.
In December 1927, at the 15th Congress of the Communist Party, the Commissar for the Inspection of Workers and Peasants, named Ord Zonkikats, he's a very, very weird name to pronounce, I can't even pronounce it, reported that Jews were represented thus in the central apparatus of the Bolshevik government. 10.3% of the Soviet officials in Moscow were Jews. Jews constituted 1.8% of the population of Russia. 22.6% of all Soviet officials in Ukraine were Jews. Jews constituted 5.4% of the population of the Ukraine. 30.6% of all Soviet officials in Belarus were Jews. Jews constituted 8.2% of the population of Belarus. Gives you some idea of the scale.
Right. Now, were these the earlier Khazars?
Sorry?
Were these the earlier Khazars from when, 700 to 800 AD? Were those the earlier Turkish-like people that...
No, the Khazars? Not,
mm-hmm.
The Khazars are not related to the Ashkenazim. It's a myth, unfortunately.
Okay.
Basically, genetic tests have shown that the Orthodox interpretation of the Ashkenazim, as well as additional historical studies I might add, that the Orthodox interpretation of the Ashkenazim, basically they come from Italy and Spain. They go up via France and Austria into Germany, then down into the Balkans and across into Poland. Then, as this basically is a series of expulsions, and then Poland lands them up in the Pale of Settlement. They then spread slightly further out to Russia. And from then on, so yes, you are right. There are Ashkenazim. It's just that the Ashkenazim are not, in spite of many people believing it, they're not Khazars. Because the Khazars, the theory, if you read the work of the only summary writer on the issue, which is Kevin Allen Brook, the Jews of Khazaria, he says quite bluntly, in spite of being a proponent of the thesis, he said quite bluntly, the amount of evidence for it is very, very low. And, you know, you can explain that what some of the genetic tests have shown, which is that there is some Turkic DNA in there, in the Ashkenazim, by possibly the Khazars, but there is also other things to consider, like the Dagestan Mountain Jews, the Persian Jews, possibly crossbreeding between sort of Gentiles and Jews and what have you, because we know these things happened.
Okay.
So
now, let me ask a question.
Sure.
What was Stalin's feeling about the Jews? I mean, he did get rid of a lot of them later on when he was doing his purging. But was it a Jewish issue, or did they just happen to be Jews and people that he wanted to get rid of, despite whatever ethnicity they were.
Okay. This comes into a lot of what I'm going to discuss. But, okay. To explain. Stalin was an opponent of Lenin. So he's an opponent of Lenin's ideas. Now, at the time, nobody knew Lenin. Lenin was, of course, Jewish. Yet Lenin was popularly perceived as the major Gentile in the entire Soviet regime, with the exception of Bukharin. The issue is that Stalin was basically he continued Lenin's ideas, because Lenin held that nationality meant nothing. It was simply a bourgeois construct. He was following Marx here. He was initially inclined to allow the nationalities, because they had been so oppressed and that people were used to expressing themselves like that, some measure of independence. They were allowed their own, what we call SSRs, or oblast. Basically self-governing regions. The Jews were allowed one. They had their own Jewish national, they had a Jewish section of the Bolshevik Party in 1918. And then in 1924, there was kind of the creation of what we call the Jewish National Committee, which included Stalin, incidentally, as well as many non-Jews like Mikhail Kalin and what have you. They then began the Bilobidzhan project, as you mentioned, to create an oblast for the Jews. But the Jews, of course, didn't like this because it wasn't prime land. So there was various Jews in the Soviet press who argued that the Jews should be given Crimea and that the local inhabitants should be cleared out and the Jews allowed to settle. Not very pleasant, but there we go. Stalin believed that nationality was basically, as I said, a social construct. In the 1930s, he began to go back on Lenin's policies because he felt that nationality would never be stamped out unless they made active, sort of encroaches in the area. So he began the process of getting rid of some of these SSRs and encroaching upon their power structure. And part of what he had to do was, because he was a Leninist, was a opponent of Lenin's what we call the vanguard party idea. Like, he basically a small cadre ruling the people so that to lead them to socialism eventually. Part of that was that he needed to get rid of people with heterodox views. Now, a lot of the people who had come up through the ranks during Lenin's time, of which Stalin was one, held very different views of what Marxism was, what socialism was to be, what policies were to put in place, and what have you. That's why you get the competition between Stalin and Trotsky, this competition between Stalin and Bukharin, the Stalin and Kamenev and Zinoviev. And during these fights, you get an increasing amount of casualties among the Jews. In particular, in 1936-1938, the Jews were very heavily hit. But as you said, the reason for that is not because the Jews were being persecuted. That is because the Jews were disproportionately represented in Soviet organizations, which effectively meant that the Jews were going to be disproportionately hit by the purges. However, we can get some idea that the Jews weren't as badly affected as they like to make out by pointing out that, for example, David Altenberg, who was the editor of the Red Army newspaper Krasnaya Zvezda in 1941 to 1943 and so forth, was Jewish, and he extorted Soviet soldiers to commit mass murder on a routine basis, just like Ilya Ellenberg, who everyone of course knows. Another one, examples, are people like Alan Stoltz, who was the great apologist for the White Sea Canal and all the people who were killed because of that. So he was lauding Stalin, saying how wonderful the conditions were as people were being starved to death, beaten to death, and tortured to death in sort of the north of Russia. Pleasant. At the same time, you've got Naftali Frenkel, who was running one of the camps on the White Sea Canal. You've got Semyon Kilov-Shain, who was Stalin's favorite soldier, who was a Jewish tank commander and was made into a Soviet propaganda hero. A similar figure is David Dragunsky. He was another Jewish tank commander, a Stalin favorite, and the opponent of the purge of the rootless cosmopolitans. Rootless cosmopolitans basically being supposedly all Jews. This is complete nonsense. You've also got Viktor Abakumov's longtime deputy, was a Jew named Solomon Milstein, and who was later head of the third directorate of the NKGB, which is a successor to the NKVD. And is recorded by the most recent author on the subject of Smersh, who is Vadim Berestein, to have organized Smersh killings, and also the Smersh killings by the dozen, and most famously, he was the principal organizer of the NKVD massacre at Katyn Forest. So the Jews really did do it. A big part of his responsibilities during the war was to run the censoring system so that soldiers' homes, letters home from the Red Army to their families, their friends on the home front would be appropriate. So they would take out all the anti-Semitism that was quite common in the Soviet Army towards their own leaders and what have you, and they would just promote this idea of the socialist society that was working correctly. In fact, it wasn't. You've also got the Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee, who were the main originators of the Holocaust myth, who included such Jewish notables as Solomon Lodovsky, who was director of the Jewish National Theatre in the USSR. You've got the biologist Lena Stern and others. And they had a lot of contact with American Jews during the war. You had a lot of, and there was a lot of interchange between their contacts, people like Sholem Ash and Benzion Goldberg, who propagandized heavily for Stalin in the US, for example, during the war. However, at the end of the war, these groups continued their close contact with Western Zionists as well as Western intellectuals. And having propagandized heavily on the basis of their Jewish identity, they began to say, well, I don't really want to assimilate anymore. I want to be Jewish, but perhaps my commitment to socialism is correct, but I can't not be Jewish. So I disagree with Stalin in terms of what we call the national question in Marxism. And at this point, in history, we cannot stress enough that you've got a confluence of issues. You've got the growing might of Zionism, you've got the growing nationalism of the Jewish and Soviet intellectuals, which led to Zionist contact with the West, as well as the Westernization of Soviet intellectual culture in the same process. So Soviet intellectuals had gone to the West and they'd been exposed to new ideas, new concepts. And they'd begun to include these in what they were writing and what they were, thinking. So Stalin, after the war in 1946, had his culture czar, one Andrei Zhdanov, launch a very public cleansing of what he called cosmopolitan ideas and the intellectuals associated with them. So he began to attack what he called non-Russian literature. This literature that was coming from alien powers from the West. And part of it was the closure of Jewish national institutions by 1948 and the beginning of the famous Doctor's Plot purge of the same year. Effectively, the Jews brought it upon themselves because they were openly talking about Zionism, their Jewish identity, which were complete opposite to what they believed. And they knew Stalin was paranoid. And they knew what was going. They should have known what was going to happen, but yet they did it anyway. And now they are now claiming that it's anti-Semitism. Stalin was an anti-Semite, hated Jews, and what have you. As such, it is very difficult to argue that the rootless cosmopolitans were Jews, because the rootless cosmopolitans come before the Jews were even involved in the issue. The fact that the Jews were hit disproportionately was largely because they stood out as being the group who were supporting this westernization by their contacts with Zionism. And indeed, you can kind of see what they're thinking, because Israel has just been established. This was thought impossible 20, 30 years before.
Right.
It's been established. But Marxism has seemed to have failed, because you've got a dictatorial state that's going around killing people en masse. You've just had the trials of the Jewish leaders in the Eastern Bloc, which, interestingly, Molotov actually wrote to the Hungarian Communist Party, for example, as well as the Czech Republic, and he said to them very bluntly, do not have Jews at the head of your parties when you get into power, because historically, in those two countries, the Communist Party has been almost exclusively Jewish. What did they do? They had Jews in power. What happened? Riots, pogroms, the lot. And basically, the attack on these call treason trials was basically to get rid of them because they were just seen as so dangerous to socialism because they were doing things their own way and causing problems for Stalin.
Right. All right. We do need to stop for a break. We will be right back in 3 minutes.
Chlorine, fluoride, pathogens, and more are in the water you drink day to day. Do you want the ability to remove and reduce those harmful things in the water you drink? You can. How? With a Berkey water filter. A complete standalone gravity filter system that requires no electricity and no plumbing. Use for emergencies or for every day. Berkey systems come in 7 different sizes. Where can you get one? From GetBerkey.com. That's GetBerkey.com. With the purchase of each system, you get 50% off accessories, such as fluoride filters, water level spigot, and sport bottles. Plus, free shipping on all orders over $25. For a limited time, get 5% off all ceramic systems when you use coupon code RBN. Call GetBerkey at 855-GetBerkey. That's 855-438-2375. Or visit GetBerkey.com. That's GetBerkey.com.
Don't answer it! How can I stop these annoying collection calls?
Imagine being free from your debt without settling and with no payment plan, no negotiating or filing bankruptcy, and no attorneys. What if you could eliminate the risk from all your unsecured debt in about 90 days and keep all your money? You can. It's called Zero Debt Guarantee, and it works. There's no other program of its kind on the planet, and we guarantee the results in writing. Call now, 800-477-9256. Let our team of experts provide you with resources to fight back, stop collection calls, and prevent and stop wage garnishments and bank levies. If you're facing foreclosure, we can help. Don't go it alone. Get free information now by calling 800-477-9256. Talk to an expert who has also completed our program. Call 800-477-9256 for free info or go to ZeroDebtGuarantee.com. That's 800-477-9256 or go to ZeroDebtGuarantee.com.
Are you struggling to reclaim your health? Let me share my story quick. My nightmare of chronic fatigue, PTSD, and autoimmune issues cost me everything. A bankruptcy, loss of home, even my wife walked out on me with no hope in sight. A miracle happened after hitting my lowest point. I discovered Ion and RNA drops. It literally saved my life. I want to share my story with you and offer you a trial size mini bottle of RNA drops. Visit www.rnafreemini.com. Again, that's www.rnafreemini.com. It's time to take your power back now. You can also look for our free trial offer ad at republicbroadcasting.org, RNA drops.
Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Carl Rattle. His website is SemiticController.blogspot.com. All right, continue.
Where were we? Okay, the purge of the ruthless cosmopolitans. The ruthless cosmopolitans, as I said, were basically these were westernizing Soviet intellectuals, and a good part of them were Jewish. And that's the origin of the whole claim, in that if so many of them are Jewish, so the claim goes, Stalin must have been anti-Semitic and must have been going after Jews specifically. This isn't really the case, because Stalin did attack many Jews, but he wasn't going after them specifically. He was going after Westernizers. And of course, a big element of that were the Zionists. And of course, with the rise of Israel, all of a sudden, all these Jews had come out of the woodworkers going, oh, look at Israel, we must support Israel. And indeed, in the very early years of Israel, in 1948, 1949, 1950, the Soviet Union was very supportive of Israel because it hoped that the Israeli Communist Party would gain power. As soon as that happened, as that dream collapsed, and it happened very quickly in, I think it was 1949, 1950, the Soviet government took a very different point of view. It argued that Zionism was no longer a national movement of liberation, as it would be termed in Marxism. Rather, that it was an imperialist plot to dispossess the Palestinian people. And to do that, they could cite the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which indeed the Bolshevik government had actually released in 1917, causing much embarrassment to the British and the French. The fact that this has been so argued is really because the Jews want to make Stalin out to be an anti-Semite, because the problem is, you see, that Jews figured so heavily in Stalin's regime that it's very hard to argue that it was an anti-Jewish regime, unless you can find an event that seems to target Jews specifically.
And of course, they always exploit all of those events.
Well, yes. I mean, this is something a lot of people don't know. But in addition to the whole thing about what they call post-Holocaust survivor syndrome, basically the children of Holocaust survivors say that they are traumatized by the Holocaust, and apparently their kids are as well. Don't ask me how that works. I've read the rationalizations. I can't work out the logic. It seems to be they're Jews, give them money, pretty much, would be the what it boils down to. However, they've been trying for the last couple of years to do the same thing to the Russians about the doctor's plot and the purges of 1936-1938, because they can see that it's becoming very, very hard to sort of extract more money from people about the Holocaust. So what did they turn to? It would be Stalin and Stalin's, in quotes, anti-Semitic pogrom of 1948-1953.
All right, hold that thought. We do have to take our 60-second top-of-the-hour break. We will be right back after station ID.
Are you against